This is Kate Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This episode is being recorded February 26, 2014. And today we are talking to Derek Bailey about his new venture, Signal Leaf.
Hey, hey.
And welcome, Derek. And sitting in on us, sitting in with us is Rob
Sitting
Connery.
On top of you?
Yes. Running roughshod over
I'm
a podcast.
I'm going to destroy this podcast. I will do my best.
So welcome to Connery Minutes, episode 2.
Oh, dear.
This is going to be hurting Connery is what this is going to be. So let's start with the obvious question. What exactly is Signal Leaf?
So it's a podcast audio hosting service that I started up about 6 months ago. It was kind of on a whim, which was fun. It was somebody on a mailing list asked, hey, what's a good place to host some audio for a podcast? And I thought to myself, I wonder what it would really take to do that. So I started digging and started playing, and it kind of turned into a business.
So this seems like one of those ideas where once you hear about it, you kind of like slap your head and like, of course, why isn't anybody doing this?
Well, the crazy thing is there are a lot of people doing it. I think that's why a lot of people don't get into this particular business. There's probably a dozen other hosts out there, and a couple of them are really, really, really big, like Libsyn. They're the big players in the room. Everybody knows Libsyn. But there's a bunch of other players out there that are pretty popular as well. And I'm kind of like the little guy in the room trying to pick up scraps off the table that are falling off of everyone else's plate.
I had not heard of Libsyn. That's interesting.
When I've looked around, that's been the one. So I'll get this out of the way, stupid confession or whatever, but we still, when we started like over 5 years ago, we started using WordPress on Scott Kuhn recommended Site5, and we got a unlimited bandwidth, unlimited storage for, it was like $5 a month or something. So I was like, okay, we'll do this until we run out, until they kick us off.
Right.
And then I've been tweaking WordPress ever since to like cache everything and do, you know, like do basically nothing on the server. And then they haven't kicked us off yet, but I'm sure it could be a lot better, you know. But the hard thing, it seems like, is bandwidth, right? Is that the main cost?
Yeah, that definitely is. So what I'm doing is I'm not actually storing any files on my servers. My actual service runs on Heroku, which is pretty awesome. But when you upload a file to Signal Leaf, you're not uploading it directly to Heroku. It's going straight to Amazon S3. Bandwidth is definitely the main expense. Actually got hit pretty hard with that today. A podcast that I started talking to almost 4 months ago finally released their first episode this morning at around 11:20 a.m. my time. And they've had like 6,000 downloads of their first episode just today. It's like it's insane. It's cost me about $20 in bandwidth just today. I'm getting kind of worried about what they're going to do to my bandwidth costs over the next month or two or three as they start releasing episodes every week. But bandwidth is definitely the primary cost in doing this service.
And so how do you sort of mitigate that? Do you just kind of like hope that the law of averages kind of smooth that out?
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. There's probably 15 active podcasts on Signal Leaf right now, and the average podcast will cost me 20 or 30 cents per month. So it's not a whole lot for those guys. My second largest podcast has been getupandcode.com.
Mm-hmm.
And he, John Sonmez and Iris Clausen, they do about 1,000, 1,200 listens per episode over about a 6 week period. But that doesn't cost me a whole lot. They were costing me maybe, you know, $5 a month. But this new podcast that came online today with 6,000 downloads in one day, that's putting the world of hurt in my pocketbook right now.
So what, you know, obviously there's hosting. Do you do other things as far as helping people get set up? I mean, I've seen the, like, number one is people should be aware of your blog. Like, you've posted a lot of really good information there. Is that kind of the main thing where you say, here's the information and then get us your files?
Yeah. So I do, along with the audio hosting, I provide an RSS feed and I give you stats for your episodes for your podcast as a whole, but I limit it at that. Basically, I don't do all of the additional stuff like Libsyn. You can get a whole hosting platform where you have a limited WordPress blog and you have a whole bunch of additional things like custom software for iPhones and whatnot. I'm not interested in doing all of that stuff. But with my blog, I definitely try to get good information out there on how to get started podcasting, the things that you really need to do, the pitfalls that people often run into, the problems that, you know, other podcasters are facing and solving. And I've got, of course, my own podcast on there as well. So I'm interviewing other podcasters. Like, I interviewed Rob Connery recently. That was my most recent episode where we talked about how he builds stories out of interviews. And it turned into an interesting conversation where he interviewed me on my podcast in order to illustrate how he does that. But the whole thing is based around really keeping podcast hosting simple for people that just need a place to put the files and get the RSS feed and get stats out of it. I'm not trying to do an all-in-one, do-everything-for-you service. I really want to keep it simple.
So I have a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
You and I had talked about hosting this developer's live.
Yeah.
And so this is a curious thing, because when I made that podcast, where I came up with the idea, it was just a random me drinking a beer on my lanai.
Right.
And then I run downstairs. And I'm like, okay, let's do this. And I did it. And next thing I know, Scott Hanselman wants in, and kaboom, we're mm-hmm. you know, doing well. And so some of our top podcasts have had a lot of downloads. And mm-hmm. the reason I'm bringing all this up is you, as a business owner, have to account for the podcasts that are going to go and just drain your, because
yes.
you're charging per month. You know, you're I don't know if you're, let me see if I can put this question the right way. I don't know what your rate structure is necessarily, but you're going to have to account for the podcasts that all of a sudden explode because maybe podcast hoster X is in jail for some reason and people want to hear what's going on. So how do you account for that?
That's the difficult part. That's my pricing structure right now is kind of the industry standard. Well, you know, $5 a month, you can upload this much. But I'm going to be changing that soon to where you'll have a bucket of not uploads, but a bucket of releases for a given month. So the way that I want it to work is I basically want to allow you to upload as many episodes as you want, you know, history or future or whatever it is, preload episodes that are going to release in the future. That's the big thing that's driving this. But I want to make it so that you can upload, you know, 10, 100 episodes at a time, and you won't get limited on how much you upload, but you'll get limited on how many you release in a given month. It just makes a whole lot more sense to me based on the conversations that I've had with other people. But as I was saying earlier, it's the bandwidth that really kills me, and the pricing structure now as well as in the future, dealing with the runaway podcast, the one that came online today is a good example of that happening to me. It's like Kevin asked earlier, it's going to be the law of averages to where the smaller podcasts, the guys that get a couple of hundred downloads per episode, you know, even if they're only paying $5 a month, that if I have 10 or 15 of those for every one runaway podcast, then it will average out to where that $100 a month in bandwidth for that one popular podcast won't be quite so bad, or will even out, will wash out with the people that are paying the $5 or the $20 and not using up all of the bandwidth that they could.
I had to focus on this intensely with TechPub because we did video.
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. was nuts.
Video will kill you.
We went streaming, and I remember – Well, anyway, I'll spare you all the gory details, but our streaming bill from Amazon was getting up to about $1,800 to $2,400 a month.
Yep.
And one day I tripped upon Vimeo and I was like, what's this? And so you pay $200 a year and they stream all your stuff for you. And I managed to save myself a ton of money because there's you know, there's services out there that do that. And right. I was just curious for you, have you looked into maybe farming out to other streaming companies, or are you just going straight Amazon?
It's straight Amazon right now, but I have things set up so that it really doesn't matter what the back end is for streaming. Right now, my front end uploads the file directly to Amazon, but my back end doesn't really care a whole lot. It's just like, okay, you want this episode and of this podcast? Well, this file happens to be located here. Let me do the redirect for you. So I could, and I do plan on looking into alternatives, but right now I don't really see a need to, even though I'm going to get a nice big, you know, whopping $50 or $100 bill at the end of this month or next month. I don't see that as a deterrent for cost right now. Honestly, I'm spending $150 a month on other services to keep this up and running. But I do expect that my bandwidth costs will very quickly outpace that.
Is that how much this Scotch home delivery service costs now?
Yeah, the call up my friend and have him deliver me a new bottle of Scotch.
Can I, you mentioned earlier you've got Heroku, and I mean, we're all nerds here. What do you got behind the scenes as far as what's running this?
Oh, you know, lots of stuff.
Like Mongo or what's
yeah. Yeah, so it's MongoDB running on MongoLab. One of my favorite services right now that I'm using is called Keen.io, K-E-E-N.io. It's an analytics on demand service. So all of my reports, everything that I generate for statistics and RSS subscribers and downloads and all of that, I'm not actually crunching those numbers. I'm shipping data off to Keen.io and then calling their API in order to get the numbers crunched for me. It's like the most brilliant thing in the world because I hate doing number crunching and things like that, especially out of MongoDB, because it's just notoriously bad about being able to do that stuff. So there's those. There's cloudamqp.com, which is a RabbitMQ software as a service. I'm using that to keep all of my pieces separated but communicating with each other. So when you go and let's say you're listening to a podcast that happens to be hosted by Signalleaf, when you request that file, the file is downloading from Amazon S3, which is, of course, another service I'm using. But when you actually make the file request through my server, I ship off a message through RabbitMQ, and that way I can track the download, but I don't bog down you, the listener, waiting for that tracking to occur. I ship the message off through CloudAMQP, through RabbitMQ. I have another service that picks up the message and does the actual tracking, which pushes the data out to Keen.io. So it's pretty slick in terms of the way I have it set up. I've got a couple of other services in there as well. I can't remember offhand which ones they are, but there's a few more that I'm using in order to keep from having to build all of this infrastructure myself. I'm not interested in building infrastructure. I want to build features for podcasters.
Mm-hmm.
So before I go even further down in the weeds here, so speaking of features for podcasters, what are kind of the big bucket features that a podcaster, that your service offers that a podcaster might avail themselves of?
Well, the core things that you really need as a podcaster are bandwidth, file storage, and RSS. Those are the things that make a podcast. If you don't have those things, you really don't have a podcast. You just have a file sitting with somewhere that people can download. It's the RSS feed. It's the bandwidth and storage. It's those things that are a must. Of course, every podcast audio host out there is going to provide some sort of analytics as well, myself included. I've got a pretty simple set of reports for podcasts as well as down to the individual episode level right now, where I show the number of RSS subscribers for your podcast. I'll show you what episodes are trending this week and this month in the podcast, and I'll give you total downloads. The thing that I offer that is truly unique, though, among all the podcast hosting is if you take advantage of my RSS feed as well as my embeddable audio player for your blog posts, I can tell you where your listens are actually coming from. And I did a blog post earlier today at blog.signalleaf.com where I show how up to 50% of your listens are actually going to come through your blog post, not through your RSS feed like most people would think.
Mm-hmm.
There's a well-known podcaster, smartpassiveincome.com, Pat Flynn. He did a site redesign 6 months ago, a year ago, something like that. And in the first deployment of his site redesign, his traffic for his podcast tanked by 50%. And that was shocking to him. He had no idea. And it turned out it was difficult for people to find his episodes on his website. So they fixed the website and his traffic went back up. And so I heard that and I saw that on his blog and I started wondering about that. And so I did some analysis of the podcasts that I'm hosting earlier today, and I verified that a handful of the most active podcasts that I have are directly getting that 50% mark, you know, 50-55% of traffic going through the blog posts for the individual episodes. It turns out that that's the number one way that people find you and listen to your podcasts.
That I've seen the same thing, and it's like really surprised me.
Yeah.
And like optimizing, you know, just the, like, I just have like an HTML5 player and
right.
stuff, but even just having that and making sure that it works on phones and works on
yeah.
the site, like, makes a huge difference compared to, like, I as a, you know, podcast listener was like assuming everybody would just use RSS and
right,
subscribe.
Right. Yeah. That tends to be the assumption that everyone has, but it turns out to not be the case. And that's something that is unique to Signalleaf. If you're taking advantage of all of the services that I offer, you'll be able to see that in your reports directly. You'll know whether or not people are using RSS or the website more often. Now, of course, not everybody's using the Signalleaf player, so not everybody's going to be able to get that level of detail. I certainly do support WordPress and PowerPress for the plugin for WordPress that helps you get your own RSS feed directly in your WordPress. You know, you can use any of those extra things that you want. You don't have to use Signalleaf's RSS. You don't have to use Signalleaf's embedded player. You can do whatever you want once you have the file uploaded. But if you do take advantage of all of the services I have, then you get those extra little whistles and bells in the report.
Yeah, that's definitely something that, like, so we have done so many things wrong on this podcast, I think. And one is we've never chased down advertisers.
Right.
And I know every time we've ever talked to advertisers, they've wanted, like, of course they want to know what they're getting for their money. And then we're
sure.
like, well, maybe we'll dig some stuff up and we can look at our, you know, AW stats or whatever and
yeah.
dig around. But, and of course, like, one of the first things you find out is your RSS feed doesn't really help at all. And so then you're digging around, you know, in your stats. And then, you know, I was just found a couple weeks ago, again, another site that rehosts all our podcasts in their player that they've optimized. So it shows up higher for a lot of Google searches than ours does. And it
right.
has a nice, like, you know, Google rich snippet and all that stuff.
Right,
son
right.
of a.
But then I'm like, well, we're not getting advertising anyhow. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we would be.
Yeah.
True. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Advertising is an interesting beast. There's some of the podcast hosts out there, Blueberry in particular, they have an advertising network built into their service. So you can sign up for their ad service and they will insert ads into your podcast for you and you'll get revenue based on that. And that's an interesting idea, but that would make me nervous, quite honestly. I suppose you would have some control over what types of ads get put into your podcast. But I mean, if I'm doing, let's say I'm doing a religion podcast and suddenly I have an ad for something that's very anti-religious or sexual in nature in my podcast, that would be kind of embarrassing. It just doesn't seem like a good idea to allow other people to insert the ads into my podcast. So I think the
air just went right out of the room.
Whoa, what?
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that Blueberry would ever do anything like that. Don't get me wrong. I honestly don't know how they control the content. I'm sure they do have some filters and some ability to control that stuff. This is just me making stuff up. But there are some free podcasting hosts out there that I have heard of. There's one particular story that I like to repeat where a podcast was using a free hosting service And in order to use that free service, it had to be hosted on their website with their ads. And right in the middle of this nice business podcast, there is an ad for sex toys. It was really just flabbergasting, just amazing how bad things can get when you really do look for free things, which mm-hmm. I mean, there's something to be said for free. I mean, we all use open source software. We're all developers here, but at some point there is a cost to these things, and it can be dangerous to take free too far.
Yeah.
So I have a question, unless anybody else does.
Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, thank you. It's a little bit off topic. Well, okay. Not really. I'm Joe developer, right? Uh-huh. Let's just say I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, I've got a nice voice. I want to make a podcast. And, you know, there's folks out there who are listening right now who are thinking, well, how do you even get started?
Yeah.
What do you do? Right? Like, I remember sitting there literally Googling, how do I do a podcast? Because I'd never done one before. And then I find out iTunes has a whole thing that you have to, like, a special feed. And, oh, Feedburner. Right. So if you had to give advice to anyone out there, aside from don't suck, which I think is the best advice ever.
Best advice ever.
Like, how would you explain to folks that want to get started using Signalleaf, how do you make a podcast and how do you make it not suck and et cetera?
Well, the most important thing to do is just hit record and say something. Quite honestly, that is really what it comes down to. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to screw up. It's going to be terrible at first. But if you just hit record and start talking into the built-in microphone on your laptop, you don't need to buy anything. Just use that microphone on your laptop. You'll start getting the hang of things pretty quickly. You'll see where you're screwing things up and how much work it takes to actually get a recording made and export it as an MP3 and all that jazz. Just hit record, say something, and try to post an episode on a service somewhere. It doesn't even matter where. If you want to just upload the file to your website and figure out how to get an MP3 player embedded into your website, now, I recommend MediaElement.js. It's a pretty darn phenomenal media player. It's that's actually what the Signalleaf player uses internally. But it's not as difficult as people want it to be, quite honestly. There's a group of professional podcasters out there, and a lot of them have this notion of, if you want to be a podcaster, you have to do these things. You have to buy this equipment. You have to be professional sounding. You have to have this in place. You got to do that. And it's like they're creating these artificial barriers for people, these hoops that you have to jump through in order to be a podcaster. And that's, quite honestly, it's a load of crap. You don't have to do those things. All you need to do is find a microphone, and you've got a cell phone, right? Just use that. You've got a laptop with a built-in mic. Just use that. You've got a video game headset that you use to chat with your buddies over Xbox Live. Use that.
Or in Scott Coon's case, you got a ColecoVision sitting in the garage.
Yes. Whatever it is, go pull out your gramophone and figure out how to hook that up to the inputs on your laptop. Whatever it is, just hit record and get started.
One of our episodes for This Developer's Life, Hanselman recorded on his iPhone. I just have to say that.
That's pretty awesome.
So you've got, like I was saying earlier, you've got this blog, and you've got one recent post, and it's the 4 worst things you can do when starting a podcast.
Yeah.
And it backs up exactly what you're saying now. And the first thing is stop waiting to start.
Right.
Don't obsess over stats and don't, you know, like, and don't stop. And I think, the same thing I've heard so many times, like, we kind of just were like, hey, let's just hit record and see what happens. And we hosted it on SkyDrive and we linked to it off of blogs and then just kind of went with it. Right. And kind of, it bums me out sometimes where I'll hear people be like, I just bought all this gear.
Right.
I'm getting into podcasting, and you look at the gear and you're like, that's $2,500 or whatever it is, you know, and a mixer and all these things. And then, like, you watch them do 3 podcasts and then 6 months and they do one more and then never again. And you're like, you know, that's going about it the wrong way. It's like,
Yeah.
It's like instead of, you know, saying, I'm going to get into computer programming, I'm going to go buy, you know, tons of computer stuff. It's like just write some code, you know.
Go buy a supercomputer.
Exactly. So, I mean, and I do get that there's cases like what Rob does with This Developer's Life. That takes editing, that takes high quality work. But for most people, I think just see where it takes you and start recording. Right. I love that advice. That's great.
Yeah, so it's like John Sonmez from Get Up and Code has said to me a number of times, people that buy the stuff first and expect it to make them good are doing it backwards, like you said. It's the process of learning and dedicating your time and making sure that you're actually going to want to do this that creates the need for that equipment. Going out and buying the equipment first is totally backwards because you have no evidence that you're going to actually get this thing done and keep doing it. You know, spend a month doing this, spend 2 months doing this, get 10 episodes out there. And then as a reward for your effort and your learning and your hard work, go buy the equipment.
So
or you can do what Herding Code did is do this for 5 years. Still don't go buy the new equipment.
Right, right. So it's funny. I have a pretty decent condenser mic. It was it's a Rode NT1A, and then we got modified by this like audio genius, a audiophile friend of ours knows, and it's supposed to compare to like top of the line, you know, $15,000 mic. And I played with using it a few times on Herding Code, and I realized it sounded a little goofy because then the guest is calling in on whatever they've got, right? Which may be a phone or maybe their headset or their laptop mic or whatever. And like it, you wouldn't notice that their mic is bad until you hear this booming, hello, speaking to you from. And so I figured, you know what? I'm just going to match what everyone else sounds like. And we use that for music, but I don't use it for like podcast stuff anymore. It takes some of the pressure off too, because I don't have to worry about it picking up any noise of anything happening in the room or me breathing or the chair squeaking.
I'll say that right now. If you want to buy a mic for a podcasting, do not buy a condenser mic. That's a really, really bad idea.
So I have to interject. People that are listening out there that, let's say, are sitting there thinking, well, Signalleaf is a really cool service. I could start a podcast and it's easy. What's a condenser mic? You know, they're going to be thinking, I have no idea what these guys are talking about. Not only that, but they're going to wonder, like, how do I record my voice? What tools do I use? And so on. I actually think it's really fascinating because your service is perfect for people that are getting off the ground that don't quite know what to do. Some of the more technical and hardware questions would be really cool to answer if you had a moment.
Yeah, let's do it. So you want to start with condenser mic?
Well, just what microphone, if you know, Mr. Developer out there or Mrs. Developer out there is working on an idea and they want to do a podcast and they're going to go down to Big Save or wherever, what microphone would you suggest?
Whatever they already have. Honestly, don't buy something if you already have a microphone, even if it's just the microphone built into your laptop. If you really want to spend some money on a microphone because you can't stand the way that your laptop microphone sounds, buy a $26 Logitech headset that you would use for Skype. See, it's $26 off of Amazon. I can't remember the exact model number, but it's seriously, you'll get 10 times better sound than you will out of your laptop mic. And you'll be able to use that thing for years to come. And like John was saying earlier, you're not going to have this amazingly booming audio quality in comparison to other people, other guests on your show. You're going to have roughly the same quality that everyone else will have. So it's going to sound good. And certainly it is going to sound better than a laptop mic. You know, from there, you can go a lot of different directions. If you want to spend $50, you can buy an Audio-Technica ATR-2100, and that's going to give you good quality sound. It's not going to be the broadcast quality sound, but it's going to be really good quality. And the really cool thing about the ATR-2100 is that it's both a USB mic, which is important for people that are just starting, but it's also an XLR mic. And an XLR, for people that don't know, is the three-prong professional microphone cable that you see at concerts and music halls and whatnot. So it's called XLR. It's balanced left-right, but it's not actually stereo. I don't know why they call it balanced left-right if it's not stereo, but whatever. And what you can about, just go, you can go up and up and up from there and get more and more expensive. I'm using a $220 Rode Podcaster microphone, for example. And I think a lot of people really like the $90 Blue Yeti, which is another great microphone. But yeah, there's, it's weird. There's lots of options.
It's weird because you still sound horrible. So what
yeah,
would you
I know.
Recommend?
It's my voice. Even this $200 voice isn't going to take the whiny nasally out of me.
I'm sorry. Just kidding. I had to say it. How about software? What do you guys use? You guys, meaning Kay Scott, who has said nothing so far. John, Derek, what do you guys use for recording software?
So it depends on the context. When I'm recording screencasts, I use GarageBand. When I'm recording podcasts with people on Skype, I'll typically just use Skype Call Recorder. Now and then I'll use GarageBand if I know the other person on the other end is going to be able to record their own audio, because you'll get better quality if you can record each person record their own track. You will get better quality that way, but it's not really necessary. You can go buy a $20 Skype call recorder and record everybody and be perfectly fine that way. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for free and you're not on a Mac, or even if you are on a Mac for that matter, check out Audacity. I think it's audacity.sourceforge.net or com or whatever SourceForge is. It's decent. It's got a lot of features and capabilities. It's just a little obtuse in terms of how to use it. So you'll want to check out some Audacity videos on how to use the features. But you can get started with nothing more than a $26 microphone and Audacity and the computer that you already have and just roll from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree pretty much on all of that. I use, like, going back to the headset, I've got the Microsoft Live Chat headset that I use for Skype. It's pretty good quality and it travels pretty well and stuff. And then I use Skype and the Skype recorder that we generally use, you can get for free, scribe.com, scribe.com. I played with several different ones because I was like, am I cheaping out and like getting an inferior quality? And what it looked like was they all use the same API. And so, you know, this company also sells transcription service if you want to pay money.
Oh, nice.
So that's what I use. And then I've used Audacity to edit the show for 5+ years. So I use other programs for doing music editing. I like using Reaper for music editing on Windows, but I love using Audacity because it's got the keyboard commands are great. Like I can edit using keyboard without even touching the mouse a lot of the time. And I can, it's very simple for one or two tracks. Mm-hmm. And then the noise reduction stuff is pretty good. And I think you've got a blog post on that too as well, right?
I do. I really love the noise reduction in Audacity. I'll export audio out of GarageBand and open up Audacity just to use the noise reduction. I actually did that on my most recent screencast. Because I had too many breathing noises and mouth noises in that screencast audio, and I couldn't get rid of it in GarageBand, so I exported to Audacity, used the noise removal tool, cleaned it up really well, good enough that I didn't care about the things that did remain, at least.
The one other thing I'd say is, and this is a good thing when you're getting started figuring out how you want things to go, is figure out how much you want to edit. So you can go from, I want a very polished radio quality show to let's just hit record and let it go. And I think on Herding Code, generally what I try and do is like we have a clean beginning and ending, and I cut out the ums and the coughs in between, and that's about it. I try, and then I also run a plugin called Truncate Silence, which just tightens up all the silences throughout. And it's amazing, over the course of say an hour, it'll cut out 5 to 10 minutes.
Wow.
Which is pretty wild, you know, and so I don't want anything to be obvious. Like I don't want people to listen and think that anything's, you know, I don't want people to listen and say, oh, this has been edited heavily or even notice the editing. But I do want it to be like just smooth and flow. And a lot of the time if people are nervous and they repeat themselves or they say or they cough a lot or whatever, it's like I just want to cut that part out, you know?
Yeah, so. Like the first time that I was on this podcast with you guys, what, a year and a half ago, talking about Backbone, I was like every other word, it was awful. I feel sorry for you having to have edited that.
It's, you know, it's what's awesome is that it's completely universal. Everyone does it. And,
right.
I have to say, since he's on the call, Rob has been the easiest person to edit. He doesn't say ever. He's like clear spoken. It's I don't edit pretty much anything he says.
Which I just is don't
maybe
edit.
A mistake.
Yeah, I just don't bother editing things. When I recorded that episode with Rob, I mean, I quite literally just hit stop, uploaded it, and I was done. I added the intro music, and that was it. No editing.
You guys are too nice. Well, seriously, not to turn into an ego party, but to be honest with you, no, Hanselman has beaten me to the point where I've kind of mastered that a little bit.
Kay Scott, you're quiet.
Yes.
Talk to us about what you're – I'm interested. I know we're talking about podcasts, but I'm curious about your recording in general. Like, what's your flow for when you do recording stuff?
Is he still on the call?
I am still on the call.
He speaks.
I'm a pretty simple person, I think. I use Audacity sometimes, and then there's Camtasia for screencasts, and that's really about it for software.
Cool.
So you don't have to edit K. Scott because it didn't say very much.
We actually have to edit K. Scott into the podcast.
Right. Right. Get some additional recordings.
Splice together a bunch of words.
Yeah. We actually had on a very early Herding Code podcast when I had a lot more time on my hands, somebody couldn't make the call, and I edited in quotes from them from several previous calls to make it sound like they were there. And and I put in like – They asked questions that made no sense, you know, and then the guest completely ignored them. And nobody ever noticed, but I had fun with it.
I like this. I think we have a TDL coming together. This is good.
That's pretty awesome.
Handsome and speechless.
I do have a question, though. Is there any particular style or subject area or something that doesn't work in a podcast format? For instance,
anything visual?
Yeah, anything visual. Okay.
So I've listened to a number of podcasts where there would be a group of people recording in a room, which is a great way to do a podcast. I've recorded a few episodes that way in person, but you have to be really careful about body language and visual cues. I honestly don't look at the other person when I'm recording in a room very often. I'll just glance at them every now and then to let them know that I'm still there, but having visual cues in an audio recording will destroy the audio because the people listening to it don't get to see the visuals.
It's a weird thing. We've had okay success with having in-person recordings, but what we've noticed is they tend to be – like when we record over Skype, usually a natural conversation goes 45 minutes, maybe an hour. Right. When we're face to face with a microphone, it gets awkward after 15, 20 minutes. It just seems to. And unless you've got like a big group of people or a huge conversation. So a lot of the time the in-person interviews tend to be pretty short. And then the same person you talk to them on a Skype call, it's an hour, maybe more if it's Glenn Block, you don't know.
Yeah. So. Or 3 or 4 hours with Rob Connery. So we've talked a lot about podcasting. You guys want to know more about what I'm doing to build it?
Since
this is a bunch of geeks and developers here.
Yes, that's probably enough podcast wankery for the
right
for one show. Podcasting about podcasting is the worst kind of meta.
I think we should all guess and see who gets closest.
Well, you pretty much know what it is at this point.
I don't. I don't know what you built.
Well, then you should guess because I think everyone else does.
Really? John, do you think you know what he built? His site in?
Yeah, it's
mentioned most of it earlier.
Roku, oh, you did. MongoDB, MongoLab.
Well, it could be, you know.
S3.
SharePoint. Okay, so it's on SharePoint, right?
SharePoint. I know. SharePoint. What does that mean? I don't know. You're saying like Mongo as if it means he's built it in what?
Mongo. Rob, I'm embarrassed for you. Mongo is a... It's an MVC framework for JavaScript.
That's right.
If in doubt, if you don't know what something is, it's a JavaScript MVC framework.
Okay. All right. Good. Does it work with Internet Explorer?
No.
No, seriously.
It's only backward compatible to IE 11. Sorry.
All right. No, I want to know. Kevin, what do you think you built it in?
I think it's some sort of script that's like Java, maybe.
The Java. Okay. John?
Yeah, another vote for Java.
All right.
I think it's Kate Scott. J2ME.
Yeah, I assumed it was Node that was serving this up.
I did too, but then I started to wonder if it might be Sinatra.
Nope, it's all Node.
Of course it's Node, for God's sake.
I don't know. I didn't hear him say it.
It's Erlang. It's really good. No, it's all Node.js. It's I kind of see Node.js as my go-to for projects these days. I tend to default to that. For a while, I was defaulting to Ruby and Sinatra. It was the easy way for me to get things up and running. And then a couple of years ago, a friend of mine, Sebastian Motragi, works for Twitter now. He introduced me to the wonders of Node.js. We were driving back from a conference in Oklahoma City, and in the middle of Oklahoma at a gas station, a rest stop gas station, he pulls out his laptop and says, I'm going to teach you Node.js. And so he did, and it was amazing. And I don't know if it was just the fear of sitting in a gas station in Oklahoma or if it was the excitement of Node.js, but I fell in love with it, and I haven't really looked back since.
Well, wait, so there's Node, but I mean, everybody knows that when you program in Node, you're using a bunch of stuff too, right? So what do you got for libraries? What are your favorites of late?
Well, for the web framework, it's Express.js right now. The guys that built Express have some newfangled thing come out that I can never remember the name of that looks really awesome.
Koa.
But it looks kind of low level. Anybody remember the name of that one?
Koa.
Koa.
Koa, yes.
Has anybody tried that yet? I haven't actually looked at it, or I haven't tried it any more than just looking at the examples, and it looks very low level, but it looks really cool at the same time. Let's see, what else? I'm using Amazon S3, of course. A lot of what I'm doing with S3 is just their RESTful API. So when you go to upload a file to Signalleaf, what I do is when you hit the submit button, I'm actually using a little bit of JavaScript in your browser to intercept that button click. I'm making a call back to my server to say, hey, I'm adding a new episode, and then my server will create a pre-signed, pre-authorized Amazon S3 URL. It will send that back to your browser, inject that into the form, and then submit the actual form with your episode to Amazon S3 directly. So you're never actually uploading a file to my services. I don't touch your file at all. It goes straight into Amazon S3 buckets. And then when you make a request to my service to get the file, you know, a listener comes along and says, I want to listen to episode whatever of your podcast. You have to go through Signalleaf to make that request. I set things up securely so you can't just go out to Amazon and download it directly. But once you make the request through Signalleaf, again, it does a pre-signed URL with authorization. And it makes the request out it does a redirect. You make the request to Signalleaf, and it sends you a redirect to the actual Amazon URL with the pre-signed URL so that you can download the file and listen to it. So I'm never actually serving files directly from Signalleaf, which is one of the things that I like to tout, because you're never going to have problems with bandwidth or speeds or anything like that with Signalleaf service. You're getting file served from S3, you know, world-class Amazon services here. So there's a bunch of other things that I include that I do as well. You know, every application is going to throw errors now and then, and I use raygun.io for that. It's a pretty slick little service to track errors and be able to give you information about what your application is doing. I mentioned Keen.io earlier for application analytics. Love Keen.io's service. I use Stripe for payments, so Stripe.com, they make it really easy to get payments and set up subscriptions and things like that. I use MongoDB document database as my data store, and I use Mandrill app, M-A-N-D-R-I-L-L app.com. It's a sister company or service of MailChimp. Basically, Mandrill is SMTP, or you being able to send email as a service, which is really nice. But all of this really, honestly, comes back to a blog post that I did on Los Techies a month or so ago. which just points out how little it takes for somebody to build up a service these days. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, all of these things that I just mentioned, these would be services that I would have to build and install and configure in my data center somewhere. And it would be hundreds and thousands of dollars to do all of this. And now I'm looking at, you know, maybe a couple of thousand lines of code inside of SignalLeaf for all of the features and capabilities that I currently have. And the vast majority of what I'm doing is just mashing together other services in order to create the functionality that I need to host the podcast audio and give you the RSS and track the stats of everything that you're doing. It's really pretty awesome to be able to build a service like this without having to build all of the infrastructure for it.
The most important question then would be, what text editor do you prefer?
Yes, I am Vim all the way. I'm one of those hardcore idiots that likes to reduce keystrokes and have a modal editor. I started using Vim a couple of jobs ago as a plugin for Visual Studio. I was doing a lot of VB.net at the time, and VB.net bores me to tears. So I installed this Vim plugin so that I could keep my mind entertained while I was writing VB.net. And learned Vim that way and have stuck with it ever since. And I'm quite happy that I did as well, because I'm actually working on a contract for a medical organization these days. And we're configuring and installing some software inside of some Linux virtual machines. And I have all of my editor right there. You know, I've got Vim on my Mac. I've got Vim in my Windows VMs. I've got Vim in my Linux VMs. And I have it configured the same in all of those locations. I just drop my VimRC file, install the plugins that I need, and I'm rocking my editor the same place, the same way in every different operating system.
Now we got to spend a half an hour talking about what Vim plugins you use and what your VimRC settings are. Yes. This is a whole other podcast.
It is.
Vim Chat. It's a new podcast.
That's right.
So one beginning noob question on that, but you were saying when you were doing VB.net, were you using VS Vim?
No, I was using the one that was around prior to that, VIEMU.
Okay.
I have not actually used VS Vim. I think I tried VS Vim in its early days, and it was nowhere near as stable or as feature complete. So I stuck with VIEMU, and I still have a license for it too.
So, so the obvious question, front end JavaScript library, MVC library, is it Angular or Ember?
Backbone. trick question.
Gotcha. Okay. Of course, Backbone. Yes. Using Marionette, I assume?
Yeah, most of the time.
What about other like node modules or libraries, like aside from the service that sort of third-party services you use? What about, you know, testing and other kinds of node modules?
Testing, you're going to shoot me or laugh at me. I have no automated testing inside of SignalLeaf right now, and I'm actually kind of horrified at myself for not having any. It grew out of an experiment and an idea and playing around, and I never went back and put any testing in place, and I desperately need to do that. But some of my go-to libraries in Node.js for NPM modules, the Q library for promises. I think promises are a tremendously important subject in JavaScript these days, and I'm super happy that they're being added to JavaScript itself in an upcoming version. So I like Q for promises. I also really like RSVP for promises. The benefit of RSVP is that it conforms to the same spec that the real upcoming JavaScript promises are based off of. I tend to use Q more often because more libraries in Node.js use Q, at least in my experience for the libraries that I'm using. People tend to use Q anyway, so I'm just like, all right, whatever. I'll use the one that everybody else is using because it's already installed for me. I don't have a whole lot of other go-to libraries, honestly. No, I take that back. I have a couple of more. _JS, which adds a lot of features that Node is slowly building in anyways. And then Moment.js, which if you're ever doing anything with dates and times in JavaScript, never, ever, ever, ever try to do it yourself. Just go grab Moment.js and use that. It will dramatically simplify your life. There are so many bugs and so many problems that I ran into in SignalLeaf with uploading files and setting publish dates and all that. And I finally just sat down one day and replaced all of my custom JavaScript date time stuff with Moment.js. Took me about an hour to do it, and I fixed all of my problems in doing it. So that's probably it for my go-to libraries. I don't have a whole lot of them, quite honestly.
Are you a fan of using Grunt or Gulp or anything like that?
Yeah, actually, I am. I do. I use Grunt a lot. I haven't tried Gulp yet. It looks pretty slick. I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever. I use Grunt. It works for me. Why do I need to change? But at the same time, the one thing that does drive me nuts about Grunt is that it's all configuration. I loved Ruby and Rake because I was writing code for my build tasks. And Grunt is going back to the world of configuration of your build tasks. Gulp, I guess, gives you the ability to write code. You do all the stream stuff in Gulp and with pipes and whatnot. It looks pretty awesome. I just haven't had a chance to try it yet. Oh, I got a Heroku tidbit that we can talk about. So SignalLeaf is deployed on Heroku, like I've mentioned a few times. One of the things that I don't like about Node.js is the way NPM, the Node Package Manager, wants you to have a Git repository or a deployed Node package or a custom NPM server somewhere for all your modules. That kind of drives me nuts because I've got about 20 different little one-file modules in SignalLeaf, and I really do consider these separate modules. These aren't just files that I'm requiring somewhere. These really are separate modules of functionality. But I don't want to have a private NPM server. I don't want to have 20 Git repositories. I don't want to have all these crazy things in place so that I can keep it, so that I can have easily installable and deployable little modules. I want one Git repository with all my code, but I also need to deploy that one Git repository to multiple Heroku applications. And if you've ever used Heroku, or if you've never used Heroku, I should say, the way Heroku works is you do a Git push, and when it sees the Git push, it spins up your application based on a proc file, procfile, and your proc file tells Heroku what to run for that application instance. Well, you can only have one proc file per repository, and you can only have one repository per Heroku application. So what I do is I took the process that I found in the Octopress blog engine, and I use separate repositories for deployment than I do for code. So I've got one repository that has all of my code for the web server and the media server and the message queuing handlers and everything that I have going on is all in one repository. But when I deploy to Heroku, I copy the individual files that I need for the individual service to a separate repository, and then I push that separate repository up to Heroku. So that way I can manage all my code in one place, copy everything over for deployment, and push that out to Heroku. And I've got a blog post coming up Thursday morning, the 27th, that outlines this in pretty good detail. So it's a pretty slick little setup, I think, although it's got a couple of downsides. But it's one of those things where there are other options and other alternatives for making this happen. All of them have drawbacks. All of them have benefits. Which one is going to best fit your situation?
Are you using the Git aspect of NPM for this?
I am not. That's pretty much what I just said, that I don't want to use Git to store my individual modules as separate repositories. That drives me crazy. I honestly, what I really want is for NPM, for my package.json file to let me point to a local folder and have NPM pick up my module out of the local folder instead of requiring me to use a Git repository. That to me would be the perfect solution to this, but for whatever reason, nobody will make it happen. Nobody wants that to happen on the NPM team, and I don't know why.
Yeah, we at my company we worked around this problem by soft linking our application packages into the node modules folder, which is definitely a bit of a hack, but it actually works.
Right. I don't want to do that either. That's one of the common solutions, and I hate doing that because I don't want my node modules folder in my repository. That's compiled code, and I don't deploy to the same server architecture that I develop on. I'm doing, you know, a Mac. It's not actually the same as the Heroku server. If I deploy compiled code, there's a good chance that it's not going to work right.
Have you tried?
Plus, the way Heroku works, it does all the node module caching for me. So if I redeploy the same package config file, it's not going to recompile everything. It has it all cached.
In our case, we don't check in the node modules folder. We just soft link. So the files are in like a sort of subfolder of the application. And then there's like a batch file that, or a shell script that soft links those in. So we don't commit node modules.
Right. So you do that after the NPM install happens to make sure that the folder is there?
Basically.
Okay.
So wait, I'm a little confused because NPM, if you package.json will do a file reference.
No, it won't.
Yeah, it will.
Really?
Yeah, it does a file reference and also does a GitHub repo. If you put in like Derek Bailey / thingy,
I've never been able to get it to do a file reference.
I don't think so, Rob. That's not my understanding.
I've tried and asked. Unless that's a new feature that they added.
All right, you know what? I'll back off of that. I could be completely wrong. Because, well, I do know if you do NPM install, I'll back off of that. I could be wrong. But I do know it does GitHub.
Yes, and I don't want to have 20 repositories with one file each.
Yeah, no, you don't want to do that, but that's kind of blowing.
It's stupid.
It's not what you would do.
Now, could you get around that with submodules? Because somebody was saying you can have submodules link into within the same repository, you can have multiple submodules.
I think submodules are running with Dynamite too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you should do that. I guess when I install, so this is the thing I'm thinking, is there's a lot of projects out there that will be wrappers for components. Mm-hmm. The one I'm thinking of in particular is SQLize. And granted, you probably you're on your own project and you're the only developer. I don't know if you are actually, but assuming you are.
I am.
You could get away with just having everything in one folder. And yeah, you certainly don't want to check in your node modules, and wrestling with Heroku is no fun for sure. But I think a larger architectural approach is just fine to have separate. So for instance, thinking about this in terms of Visual Studio, you have extra projects in there that you reference the DLLs and everything gets pulled in. You can do the same thing, have a major major directory and then subdirectories inside with all your individual modules, keeping everything nice and tidy and clean.
Sure.
And then in your main project, yes, you'll have to run npm install to go get the code, but it'll do it. And it's nice and clean.
So here's the equivalent of what you're saying in .NET. You deploy each of those 15 projects to NuGet and use NuGet to install it into the main system. That's basically what you're suggesting. Except you're suggesting to do it in Node land.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to put Node and NuGet together because they're completely different animals.
Node and NuGet and NPM are roughly equivalent in this case.
I think it's worth it to offer my perspective, which is that if I'm focused on doing, let's say, a shopping cart, I want to think about the shopping cart. So for me, having a shopping cart module with its own individual tests is helpful.
Oh, yeah, totally agree with that. I'm not saying don't do that. Mm-hmm. I actually do want my individual pieces to be separate modules, and I develop that way. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to go through the formality of making that separate module a separate NPM package or a separate Git repository somewhere. It doesn't make sense for me to go that far because the majority of my modules, while they are really truly separate modules that I don't want to make a part of another module, mm-hmm. they simply are not large enough to warrant their own repository, or they're not reusable. They are separate modules, but they are specific to my application, and I would never reuse them anywhere and never want anybody else to use them. So there's no point in me making them into an NPM package or putting them in a Git repository.
Certainly. And the thing I'm reflecting on is my interactions with the Ghost team, for instance.
Right.
And talking about But so if you look at their code, they have like, you know, the classic, you know, I think it's 12 lines of require statements at the top of every single module, which is, I think, what you're saying. It's, it's a very PHP way of looking at the world of just including, I need to include all these functions because I need to use them.
Right.
And the Node way is a little bit different. And so what I suggested for them is different than for you. For them, I suggested crack out your business logic into a, you know, your CMS core. Crack out your data access here. Crack out your admin here.
Yep.
For them, that might make sense because they've got a fleet of developers that could jump in and help. Write tests specific for those modules and then pull them all together later on in a build. For you, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's a little bit too much ceremony.
So the ceremony for me is just the way that you pull it together. I still split things out like that. I've got a separate module for the notion of a podcast, which a podcast contains episodes. I've got a separate module for the notion of analytics. It does all of the actual tracking of downloads. I've got a separate module for, you know, a number of different things, a number of different concepts, and I pull those modules into the individual area of the application in the web app itself and in the media server itself. So I'm heading down that path already, but the formality and ceremony that I'm avoiding is turning those things into separate NPM packages that are installable.
Totally understand. And sorry, you guys, I don't mean to hijack everything, but this is actually a really curious conversation for me. One of the things I've done before that's worked really well is I've used Grunt to actually go out and run an npm install command. And I've also used npm itself if you go into package.json and then you overwrite the init script or even start if you want to. So before every start, it will go out and will grab all your modules and then install them if you want to use a file reference. So that keeps everything in sync. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. And I guess in the past, my complaint about that was, well, at development time, that means I have to constantly stop and restart my code, but I'm doing that anyways these days. I run everything through NodeMon, which restarts anytime there's a file change, so it wouldn't be too much to add on top of that. I'll have to try that and see how well that works.
Well, if it's too much for npm start, you can also use it on init. Oh, the other thing I've done is use npm init, then you can just do it whenever you update the other modules, and then you can do it manually. Okay.
Off the track, I haven't used those tools yet, the npm init, and I haven't tried that yet, so I'll have to check that out.
Yep.
All right, I think that just about does it for this episode. So thanks, Derek, for coming on and talking to us about Signalleaf.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
I would ask you if you have anything you need to pimp, but I think that's pretty much what we've been doing this whole episode. So anything else you want to throw in there?
Total shameless self-promotion. I've got my screencasts up at watchmecode.net. I've been rebooting my effort on that recently. So if you're looking for some JavaScript screencasts and getting up to speed on Java, all things JavaScript, definitely want to check those out. And also if you're
am I still here?
Now I hear Rob.
What?
I was just going to ask him about if he's going to keep vb.vim up to date.
Wow. Apparently I'm the new Rob Connery.
Oh, wow.
Maybe we just need to cut our losses here.
Right. you said watch me code and then you said something else and then you drop.
Hello?
I'll be Derek. And check me out at marionettejs.org and signally.foo.
Yeah, so anyways, all right, let's kill it.
Okay.
Kill it with fire.
Hey, here's a neat thing. Derek set up a discount code for Herding Code listeners for watchmecode.com. So the discount code is HERDINGCODE, that's one word, HERDINGCODE, and that'll give you a discount price of $9 a month, which is down from $14 a month regular price. So that works out to 35% off. And that's valid for individual subscriptions only. So thanks a bunch, Derek, and I hope you try it out.